Good evening. Welcome to WCVE Forum. I'm Benjamin Dolly. Tonight, we hear a forum on redistricting that took place in Norfolk on September 10th. Speakers include Senator Jill Vogel, Brian Cannon, Executive Director of One Virginia 2021, and Rebecca Green, Co-Director of Election Law Program. The event was moderated by Norfolk Mayor Kenny Alexander.
Before we get started, I want to ask a question. How many of you know the first gerrymandering district, or how gerrymandering started in Virginia? I know Brian knows. All right.
He knows everything.
The first gerrymandering was engineered by Virginia's own Patrick Henry in 1788. Patrick Henry prevailed in having the General Assembly to draw the boundaries of Virginia's 5th congressional district in such a way that it would pit a candidate that had favored James Monroe against a candidate that he opposed, James Madison. However, James Madison won anyway. So, here we are, decades later, and we're still addressing gerrymandering. So, question, is there a legislative pathway to making our elections more competitive? Can our legislators agree on bipartisan reforms that puts the voters first on this issue? I certainly hope so. So now let's get to our panelists. Brian?
Mr. Mayor, okay. You can hear me just fine. Is the mic working good? Sounds like it is. Great. Thank you, guys. Thank you, not just for the water, Ron, but thank you for your hard work in putting this on. This is exciting to have so many nerds be willing to show up with us for this discussion on a Saturday.
Sunday.
I worked yesterday, too, so it all. We were at a Baptist church in Richmond having this conversation. My task here is a little bit about the history and the kind of current state of redistricting reform. But let me put this in present-day context. Everybody heard this week that Equifax got hacked, basically, right? And that all of our information is vulnerable in that regard. That makes me uncomfortable, right? My information was there. I'm assuming a fair number of you all had that same problem. It's a lot of information that they have about us. If you are uncomfortable at all about that, then let me tell you the current state of our redistricting process allows politicians to pretty much use all of that data, if they choose to buy it, and they do, to redistrict, right? It's really effective tools to find out exactly who we are, our propensity to vote, in which elections, whether you show up in a primary or whether you show up in Virginia's notorious off your elections, right? Or if you're just a presidential year voter only, right? And not only that, but whether you're a Bernie supporter or a Hillary supporter or you're a Trump supporter or a Kasich supporter, they can pretty much suss that out too. This pales in comparison to the gerrymandering, the crude gerrymandering that Patrick Henry tried to do 200 plus years ago, right? Like, he didn't have those tools. They didn't have all that credit and consumer data about us that they do now. So I don't know if you can put the genie back in the bottle and get rid of all that information. I think it's just kind of out there, unfortunately. But what I do know is we can change the system from the way it's always been to a better system to make the impact of that data that's out there about us less relevant to this process. From a historical standpoint, Virginia has gerrymandered pretty well for a long, long, long time. And we are, if you're looking at the impacts of it and how kind of nefarious or maybe how important it is, you're probably seeing a hockey stick curve coming up really recently, right? Where 2001 was the most sophisticated gerrymander we'd ever had, and that was exponentially matched by 2011 when we had it then. And it makes the 1990 and 1980 and previous efforts at gerrymandering seem pretty mild in comparison. It was still plenty partisan, it was still plenty personal, but now it's driven by incredible amounts of data and math out there. And I went to this wonderful conference that, since you guys are here today, I assume that you might have seen something about the Geometry of Redistricting conference that Tufts University had last month. It was an excellent, excellent conference. And what was cool about it is it's all those algorithmic math, comp sci people. There were very few attorneys there, which is a good thing. And those folks want to pitch in because they realize that their tools are being used for evil, right? And they want to kind of counterbalance that. And so it's really inspiring to see this kind of, as this issue rises in importance, people are recognizing it and stepping forward. Here's the other thing I want you to take away from this. This is a bipartisan problem with bipartisan actors working to fix it, right? You don't get Republicans and Democrats together on every issue, especially anymore. And it has a nonpartisan solution. And a lot of people say, Brian, there's no way to put a nonpartisan panel together. There certainly are ways to do it better. There's no way to take the politics out of redistricting. Other states have proven you can. And I think we can learn a lot what's going on. I know that my election law professor, Rebecca Green, who helped really get me energized on this in 2011, it was my last year of law school. I don't know if my wife is still here with our son. She might have skedaddled because, oh, she's out there because he's 3 years old, so he's not interested in this. But Kelly and I were married at the time in law school, and I wasn't going to go anywhere for spring break, my senior, right, 3L year of law school. And Professor Green approached us and some of, me and some other students and said, hey, there's this competition, this statewide competition that's out there. It's sponsored by the Wasson Center for Public Policy, the League of Women Voters, AARP, a bunch of good government groups all around the state. They're going to give you all the software that the big boys use to gerrymander. And you all get the chance to do it better and to follow the good government rules that we've been advocating for a long time. And the results of that experiment have borne a lot of fruit. But I would say that the top one is that it proves we can do it better. So there's hope for this. I think Senator Vogel and Mayor Alexander represent a lot of that hope in Virginia, and I think we're going to win. So I look forward to hearing what everybody else has to say and look forward to your questions.
Good. Senator Vogel.
Well, good afternoon. Can you hear me? Okay. It is wonderful and incredibly inspiring and reassuring that we can get this many people to come and talk about this issue on a Sunday afternoon. So first of all, I'm grateful. Second of all, for those of you who have been advocating this for a long time and showing up and helping us do this work, I say an extra thank you for that, because it has not been easy. I've been in the Senate of Virginia for 10 years, and starting with the first year I was in the legislature, I attempted to tackle this issue. And we only have made incremental progress because we have people like you who are someone's constituent, who do reach out and say, you know what, I do care about this issue. This falls in my mind into the broader sort of context of all the ethics issues that we have to deal with. And to be ethical legislators and fair representatives of the communities that we represent, above all, we should focus on redistricting, where you're setting up the framework, the basic framework from the beginning. You want that framework to be fair so that it is your constituents who are choosing their elected office holder and not office holders manipulating the process so that they can choose their constituents. And people fundamentally, as they are more educated about the issue, get that that's wrong. So I'm just grateful that you all are here to talk about it. When I was first elected, the Senate was divided 21-19, and in a partisan way, obviously. And there were four newly elected members to the legislature. And we were very junior, and we knew that we would likely be pretty irrelevant. But I joined with, I'm a Republican, and I joined with my colleague who was newly elected as a Democrat, and we said, you know what? We're 21-19. They can't get anything done without us because it's such a narrow margin. Even though they might not, you know, sort of start out at the beginning with having what we believe be the driving influence, but we can impose our positions on a number of issues on this legislature by joining together and creating this thing that we call the Commonwealth Caucus. And the issue that we focused on, there were three, but the top issue was redistricting reform. And it wasn't something, honestly, that people had talked about very much. And I'm glad to hear that Professor Green, you're responsible for Brian, good grief, who has worked tirelessly. I wondered where all that came from. You know, behind every man, there's an awesome woman. So anyway, who got him so educated on this issue, and it has been my great honor to work with Brian, who is an absolute machine. He has done so much work. And you know what's interesting? I will go places where I don't think anybody's ever really been, to tiny little forums as the guest speaker, and I'll mention redistricting reform. And they will say, oh, well, you must know Brian Cannon. He's been here already and spoken to our group. So if this succeeds, it will be because of the sheer force of will of Brian and others who are willing to go into communities like this one and sit down and talk to you and inspire you to help those of us who are inspired to do the right thing, pass legislation, pass a constitutional amendment, whatever it is that we can accomplish so that the next time we have a census and the next time we redraw district boundaries, that those boundaries are drawn in a way where communities of common interest are kept together, where political subdivisions are respected, and where we are considerate of the constituents that we represent. This is a constituent service matter above all else. We can talk about it as an ethics matter and all the issues that it creates, and it creates elections that are not competitive. But at the end of the day, this is a constituent service matter. Kenny read off the numbers of counties that I represent. I should represent a few counties, not seven. I shouldn't have just two precincts in Culpeper and a precinct and a half in Stafford and a little, you know, two precincts in Loudoun. I should have a community where I'm 100% accountable to a few counties who know exactly who to go to in their moments of need. Local governments who can have one person responsible and not, you know, not have to go to eight different people. So who represent them in the House or, you know, in the Senate a few. So I just wanted to say I appreciate your willingness to be here. And I just have to say one thing. It's so awesome to see Kenny again. He left the Senate of Virginia to go be mayor, and we miss him terribly. And I'm just, if you'll indulge me for one second, I was at Wakefield at the Virginia Diner yesterday, and I was talking to all these people, and I went up and introduced myself to this group, and I said I was running for office. And they said, "Do you know Kenny Alexander?" And I said, "Well, how is that going to come up in Wakefield?" Anyway, they could not say enough amazing things about Kenny Alexander. And also, one of them happens to be your neighbor. Oh. So you'll figure out who that is eventually when they tell you that they ran into some crazy person who knew you and loved you as much as they did. So thank you all for being here and letting us have this conversation.
Thank you very much. All right. Professor Green.
So I thought I would use my time to just talk a little bit about why courts haven't stepped in to fix this problem. Because at this point, I think everyone recognizes that it is a real problem, that we have a problem with hyper-partisanship, we have a problem with non-competitive elections, and we have a problem with people who can't figure out who their representatives are because the lines are drawn so strangely. So, you know, you might ask, you know, why haven't courts stepped in and sort of fixed these abuses that are happening in state legislatures all over the country? And the big reason, the big problem, the big hurdle here is that the Constitution delegates to state legislatures the power to draw the lines. And so, you know, they say the idea is it's a political process, and our representatives are the right ones to do it. They have the sophistication. It used to be that it was very technical and difficult for anyone to do, so they had sort of the technical expertise, and that was the right place for people to turn to for people to draw the lines. So this constitutional setup of state legislatures drawing the lines has been kind of, it was sort of just seen as sort of a given, and there was no way to kind of get around it. In the 1960s, a bunch of court cases came up where legislatures hadn't been doing their job. They were not redistricting every 10 years like they were supposed to under their state constitutions. And the reason why is because they were trying to hold on to power even as populations were shifting within their states. And so in a very famous case called Baker versus Carr, which you may know from the term that came out of it or the phrase that came out of it, one person, one vote, the Supreme Court got involved in redistricting and said, wait a minute, when legislatures aren't doing their job, courts can step in and try to fix it. And that was in the context of malapportionment where you had, you know, 10 people in one district and 300,000 in another, each represented by one legislator. And so the idea was courts do have a say in that circumstance when there's a process breakdown and courts need to step in and fix democracy, essentially. So once the courts started getting involved in that in the 1960s, the question then arose, well, should they get involved when legislators start drawing the lines to keep themselves in office or join forces with even the other party and keep each other in office? And you know, at what point can the courts stop legislators from doing that? And again, the problem there became, you know, if it's the legislature's job to do it, how do you figure out when it's abusive, when they're going too far? Where do you draw the line in figuring that out? The court has really struggled with that question of figuring out where that line is. and so far hasn't been able to come up with a standard that would guide lower courts in figuring out when the legislature has essentially gone too far. Recently, there have been some cases bubbling up that have suggested that there may be a standard that emerges very soon. And I'll just describe a couple that are making their way up towards the Supreme Court. The first one is an exciting theory that was first proposed by Justice Kennedy in a case several years ago, where he suggested maybe we could look at the First Amendment as a cure for partisan gerrymandering. So maybe we could look at the harm that people are suffering as a harm to their First Amendment right of association, their First Amendment right, you know, to speak essentially through their ballot. Because if you are prevented from electing candidates of your choice, that's really affecting your First Amendment right of association and your First Amendment right of speech at the ballot box. So there's an encouraging case coming out of Maryland, which is one of the most gerrymandered states in this country, where the Democratic legislature has gone nuts, essentially, keeping power up in Maryland, and there's an interesting suit to address that problem from a First Amendment perspective. And so because Justice Kennedy was the author of this idea to use the First Amendment, many people are hopeful that if the case reaches him that he may decide favorably that this is a good example of his theory. A second case I'll mention is coming before the court very soon on October 3rd. This is before the US Supreme Court. It's coming from Wisconsin, and it's a case where they're essentially trying to use math, as Brian suggested, to solve this problem. A law school professor, actually, named Nick Stephanopoulos, and his wife, Erin.
Ruth,
I always think of, yeah. Anyway, the two of them came up with this theory called the efficiency gap standard. What they said is basically, when you are a legislator and you're trying to win an election, your job is to waste as many of your opponent's votes as possible. So if your opponent only needs 51% of the vote to win, pack them in a district so that their person wins by 95%, and you've all of a sudden wasted a ton of their votes, right? Taking them out of districts and put them into that one district where their votes are being wasted. So essentially, the same is true, by the way, for losing votes, right? If your person loses by a ton, then you've wasted a lot of votes there too. And so they basically have used this to create a mathematical formula of how many votes are wasted by a given map. And they figured out that there's a range above which, at least according to their theory, there are so many wasted votes produced by a map that a court can look at a bright line for where a partisan gerrymander has gone too far. So there's a lot of people who think that the judges might latch on to that standard, that there's finally some way of measuring how much essentially is too much. So there's a lot of interest around that case that's being, as I say, argued on October 3rd at the court. Interestingly, there have been tons and tons of amicus briefs. So people who are writing friends of the court briefs, so they're not parties to the case, but they want to tell the court something about the case. And it's been really interesting to look at the coalition of people who've been writing briefs in this case. And they're all across the political spectrum, so much so that a group of, people think of this case because it's a Republican legislature in Wisconsin. People think of this as, you know, the plaintiffs being Democrats and the defendants being Republicans. But in fact, a ton of the authors of these friend of the court briefs are Republicans, which I think has really, I think, demonstrated that this is a bipartisan issue, that there are a lot of people on both sides who earnestly think that there's a better way to draw districts in this country. So a couple cases to focus on or to look for coming down the pike, and I think a lot of hope, more so than at least on the on the jurisprudential side, more hope in this area than there has been in a while. So I'll stop there.
Well, thank you very much. So we want questions, and I'm going to pose a question to the panel. But you should have cards. You all have cards? No. So if you please, okay. So I'm gonna pose a question, and if you would gather the cards, we want to hear from you what your questions are for the panel. The question that I'll raise, and while we gather the cards, based on what has been shared and what you know, is there a legislative fix or legal fix or pathway to making elections in Virginia more competitive? And I think Professor Green has opened the door to give us an insight. However, I would like to hear more from Senator Vogel and of course, Brian, as well as Professor Green. I know that racial gerrymandering has been pretty much ruled illegal, but what about political gerrymandering? So is there a legislative or legal pathway to making our elections more competitive? I'll start with Senator Vogel and go right down on this.
The answer is yes and yes. And in fact, I have introduced almost every year that I've been in the legislature some, whether it's a constitutional amendment, which is what I introduced this past year, or whether it's for legislation that would call for an independent commission, I have tried for a legislative fix. In addition to a legislative fix, there is always the courts being the other place where this can happen. And what's so ironic is that when I introduce the legislation every year, my colleagues, who are very much opposed to changing the current status quo, will say, you know what, this is a subject of litigation. And we don't pass legislation on something that is a subject of litigation. Mm-hmm. So I always find that incredibly ironic. And this is always going to be the subject of litigation until we do something. So the answer is yes. And I've tried an independent commission, both as a legislative, just as a bill, and also an amendment to the Constitution, which actually I think is probably a better way to solve the problem, because what you are doing is you are writing into Virginia's Constitution real criteria that would make this not partisan, less partisan, and make this actually a meaningful process. And once you're bound by the Constitution, it's in the Constitution.
So from a macro view on this around the country, the states that got reform, kind of what I'll say is like the first wave of reform, are the states out west, where they can put a citizens initiative on the ballot. You know, 75% of Virginians want reform of some type or another. So like, we would win. It would be a slam dunk if we had that. Almost needless to say, Virginia is not California or Arizona or Colorado or Washington, right? There's a lot of things that are different about the Commonwealth than those places. So we've got to go through our state legislature. So the question I get asked, and one of the questions I was asked when I first took this job, is, Brian, how the heck are you ever going to get state legislators who benefit from this system to give up their power? And well, I'll tell you, first thing is, if you look at history, whether it's the women's movement to get the right to vote 100 years ago, or whether it was the civil rights movement 50, 60 years ago, you've got politicians who just believe it's the right thing to do, and if I lose my seat, oh well, but it's just the right thing to do, right? So folks like these guys. But then you have to, that's necessary, but never sufficient. The remainder to get you over the tipping point is, we gotta shame the rest of them into it, right? And that's just the God's honest truth, and that's where you guys come in, right? We got to support the good folks who stand for this, but the rest of them who are waffling on it or who aren't sure if that's really possible, we got to reinforce that. But more specifically on redistricting reform, the second wave of reform is happening, and that's actually state legislatures voting to change the process. The three states that have done that this decade include Ohio, under Governor John Kasich, New York, and I'm blanking on the governor, is it Cuomo? Governor Cuomo? And then in Nebraska, and I won't say the governor's name because he actually vetoed it, but all of those state legislatures passed redistricting reform. And I'm not saying it's the perfect form or something, but it is a huge sign that they are taking it out of the hands of the legislature because they recognize the inherent conflict of interest here. So in Virginia Senate, there are 35 out of 40 senators who vote for redistricting reform. Now, I bet a few of them, if they thought we would pass in the House, would drop off of that number. But you only need 21, so I feel pretty good about the state Senate. The state Senate has led on this in a long way, and in a bipartisan way, which is really important. The House of Delegates is a little bit of a different beast, but I would say that anecdotally, we probably got somewhere between 55 and 60 votes in the House of Representatives for some type of reform, and that's huge. Now, we don't get it on these subcommittees where your good bills go to, because there's only seven members, so I don't get the right seven members. But that's the kind of form. So there is hope in Virginia, and we are close. And there's definite proof from other states that there are ways to do this, and we can learn from them and take it to the next level, hopefully in Virginia.
Okay, Professor Green.
I'll just add one thing, which is Brian could have mentioned, which I thought he was going to, that his group, One Virginia 2021, is sponsoring a really interesting court case here in Virginia where they're arguing that the state legislative lines have violated the state constitutional command that districts be compact. So they have very intelligently chosen districts that are unbelievably strangely shaped. I think one of them is called the Toilet Bowl District, if I'm not mistaken. On both sides of the aisle, and they've basically said that the legislature has no good reason other than politics to have drawn these crazy shapes. And that case is still active and winding its way through.
Yeah, we'll be before the state Supreme Court late next month.
Yep. So there's a lot of creativity going into trying to solve this problem in Virginia.
And I'll add that I think that the court cases also generate interest, right? You guys next month are going to read about three court cases in the news a lot. You're going to read about the Wisconsin case, the Bethune Hill case, which is the racial gerrymandering case, which impacts districts around here. And you're going to read about our court case. Like, it's going to be a big month. And then it just keeps the pressure on what otherwise is a once a decade process that they hope we'll all forget about.
Okay. All right. So the first question, how should we talk with our legislators about redistricting?
Well, that's easy. Call them up, call their office, send them an email, tell them that you care. Brian made a really important point about this notion that people now pay attention. They actually understand it's an issue. Because 10 years ago when I got elected and I talked about redistricting reform, I'd go to a Chamber of Commerce forum and I'd talk about the issues and the bills I carried. And I'd say, yes, and I carried redistricting reform. And people go, they glaze right over. And it's largely because, understandably, it is not something, if it only happens every decade, it's not something that people actually are aware of, and they do not understand the impact that it has on the politics of their state. They really don't. So it's not just, when we were talking about this before, a constituent service matter, so that you can do better constituent service if you have a fairer, better drawn district. It is a process where we will never accomplish it without constituent engagement, and that is where you come in. There are 40 members of the Senate, all whom have access to their electronic social media. They read what people say, they see what people post, they pay attention to the coalitions that organize and come together and visit them in their office. You talked about shaming people into it. There's also an education component. Because people really don't understand. Well, shaming it is right, but he said that might be a better way. But I'm really sincere when I say that there are many people who are just not as educated about the issue as some of us up here are. I happen to be an ethics lawyer in my day job, so I deal with redistricting issues. I understand them, truly. And what I think many of my colleagues do not understand is that if you go back over history, and I think you all can speak to this, it is almost always the case that the party in power who draws the lines and overreaches, you know, packs too many people in a district that are of one partisan persuasion or splits up a city or does something, it is almost always the case that that party loses seats and doesn't gain seats. Because when you draw districts that fundamentally are less competitive, it's not good for anybody. And frankly, it's not good for the people who represent those districts. You want competitive elections where you have an opportunity to have two people who each at least have a basically fair shot at winning an election. And what you end up doing when you're, you know, gerrymandering is you're literally creating districts where the election is irrelevant. Mm-hmm. And that is bad for everybody, and it is always bad for the party in power. So if we would talk about the facts, how this has borne out, what's happened in other states, I think people would certainly listen. So I would just say to you, it's the best question you could ask, and that is get in touch with your state senator and your House members and tell them that this is actually something that matters to you.
Okay.
Let me dive down. I hope everybody subscribes to the VPAP newsletter or looks at VPAP occasionally. They do wonderful, wonderful work on reporting donations made. Transparency is a key element to that, and they're a huge, they're pretty much the sun in Virginia for that kind of stuff. And they had a multi-question questionnaire for, they would tell you, who's your candidate for governor, right? And I think it was 11 questions, and one of them was on redistricting reform. And I thought the two ways that you got two choices when that question came up, and I thought it really framed the issue well. One is, yes, give it to an independent commission. Or two, which is, no, I like the status quo, which is not always what the people who are, they're just not, that aren't that deep into it say. The people who oppose us say, You know, ideally that's right, Brian, but it's hard to do in practice. And I will tell you, it's not impossible, but it's not easy either. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't do it. I think what you need to say is that the way to respond to that is, of course, it's not easy to do. But first thing, can we make the people that are drawing the lines not be the most self-interested people in the whole universe? Right? I mean, like, really, we couldn't find people more self-interested in these lines than the people who, you know, live by their elections in them. But two is that you can point to that student competition that I mentioned earlier from the Wasson Center, and that really proved you can have your cake and eat it too on good government criteria, on competitiveness, on respecting localities, and all the things that we would all agree kind of just on a gut level are the right things to do. You can do that. You get better lines just by the eyeball test, but also you get better lines if you run the math on them and you show competitiveness and keeping communities together and splitting fewer precincts and all the things. Like, so it really works. So while it's not easy, it's not hard, or it's not impossible.
The only thing that I'll add to that, which I think is really interesting, is the studies that are emerging about how much more public consciousness there is on this issue, combined with the fact that people can now sit at a computer in their pajama in their living room and draw maps that are workable. And so I feel like, you know, in addition to reaching out to your representatives to tell them that you care about this issue, I think we have a unique opportunity in the coming redistricting round to get involved in the process and to have your voices be heard. And I think that, unlike previous rounds, that's really going to start happening, because I think people care more about this issue than they ever have.
All right, so do legislators really listen to non-constituents, the bottom line? How can we get redistricting reform out of committee?
So I think the question is, do legislators listen to people outside of their own district? Is that what you're asking? And the answer is, well, I always have. When I was first elected, there were people that came to me. I was a mom. There were very few people like me who were in the Senate of Virginia at the time. And so people who had family issues, children's issues, issues related to autism, would routinely call me. And I would say, well, you know, you live in Roanoke. You're not in my district, but I would be eager to help you, eager for you to come in and collaborate with me on this legislation. I think most people who care and who take this job seriously will listen to anybody who comes and cares about what happens in the Commonwealth of Virginia. But to be fair, they always listen more to the people they represent. And that's obviously a function of their obligation to that community. And I talked about, you know, this is a part of constituent service. Each person who goes and pays a visit to some member, you have the ability to go and say, I'm with a coalition of people, and three of them are here from your district, and we care a lot about this issue. So to be, you know, totally crass, yes, people care more about the people that they represent, but most people, and Kenny, I think, would speak to this, who's been an elected senator, would say, of course you listen to people. You want to collaborate. This is a collaborative process. Certainly, I have listened because, for me, it's been a function of, well, how do you want to do it? Should it be a constitutional amendment? I've had lots of people come in. They have really, really good ideas. People who email me, people who are real students of this issue, folks who were involved at William & Mary in the drawing of those lines. I listened carefully to all of them because the points, you know, I have a great sense of my own limitations. I know what I don't know, and I don't know everything about everything. And so much of the good that comes out of the legislature is listening to smart people. So I think we've gotten where we are by doing that, and all we need to do is the next time there's an election and it's a new person, and this is where Brian has had so much success, a new person comes forward and says, I would like to run for the House of Delegates, or I would like to run for State Senate, and you ask them, where are you on this issue? And you explain it to them, you spend time with them, and then you make it an election issue. And that is how we've actually, I believe, made incremental progress.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, because no one runs on gerrymandering. Right, it's not in anybody's brochure that's, well, maybe on reforming it, but no one runs on saying, I like to gerrymander, right? It's like, you know, that's just not in anybody's bulletin. That's it.
Good. Does the Voting Rights Act require the creation of minority-majority districts when possible?
Man, that is a really complex question, and only getting harder to answer given the swirl of litigation that's happening right now in the Supreme Court. The basic answer to that is that if there is a minority community that has sufficient numbers and is sufficiently compact, the Voting Rights Act guaranteed, or at least I won't say guarantees, but it's there to help them to elect the candidates of their choice. And they can use Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act to prove that they have been prevented from electing their candidate of their choice. The problem with that litigation is it requires a huge amount of evidence to prove. It takes years to prove, and they're very difficult cases to bring because they just involve a huge amount of litigation and experts and so forth. So that's what the Voting Rights Act requires, but does not guarantee these days. You may be familiar with a case that came down in 2013 called Shelby County. It used to be that covered jurisdictions, so jurisdictions that had a history of voting rights abuses, had to, before they passed a plan, it had to go through something called preclearance, meaning that they got permission essentially from Washington, from the federal government, to enact a law or enact maps. So it sort of preemptively stopped them from doing something that would harm minority voting rights. But unfortunately, in 2013, the court decided that that vehicle was no longer needed. And so now we're left with this different section of the Voting Rights Act that that requires, as I say, years of litigation to kind of win your case. So that's the state of the situation now.
Okay. All right, so here's a question, and it's probably for me. Will the city of Norfolk redistrict in 2021, and what guidelines will they use? So in Norfolk, you know that we have the ward system, and it's good to see Courtney Dole. Hey, Courtney. School board member, thank you for being here, and Joe Barron, our sheriff, just showed up. So we have the ward system in Norfolk. There is only one member of the council that runs at large, and that's the mayor. Our school board will go to ward system. 2018, there are two members that are already at large. That's Rodney, Ward 7, and Dr. Gabriel, Ward 6. After the 2020 census, certainly Norfolk will revisit our system to make sure that our districts are proportioned. There is communities of interest, and that is contiguous. What those guidelines will be, I don't know yet. However, there is talk to revisit how we structured the school board elections from being ward system to it large, and also some have argued that we should have a hybrid a system, but that remains to be seen. Now, I think that we have maybe one more question.
Can I make one comment about localities? I don't want to leave this out because I think this has been overlooked, and that is yet another reason that many people do not understand in this larger context of redistricting is that there is an extraordinary cost to localities mm-hmm. when redistricting is done poorly. So when I talk about the constituents that care about this issue, there are the people in the community, there's groups like this one who actually care about this issue for the sake of doing the right thing and appreciate those who will do the right thing. But then there's this other practical dollars and cents piece of this. If you don't care about any of that and you actually care about the money that it costs you, it costs an exorbitant amount of money, exponentially more, to run an election in a district, in a county that's been gerrymandered, where precincts have been split, and where the legislature has not been able to come back and address it, or the locality has not been able to address it. You're running multiple elections in small areas. Mm-hmm. So if you think that, you know, people like you guys get upset, you should hear the registrars when we pass those maps. They are about to be scraped off the ceiling because they come to me and say, you know, this is awful. So it was an issue for me in Loudoun County, which is a county that I represent. It was an issue in Frederick. We tried to go back in the off year and make those tweaks, but now that's become incredibly hard to do. And we have not been able to do that. So there is an also just a huge cost to localities that I think we have an obligation to prevent from happening because those resources are scarce enough as they are.
Excellent point. Just to add, when I was in the House of Delegates, the Titustown precinct was split three ways. It was split between Johnny Joanna, Thelma Drake, and myself. And so when a constituent, a resident, walked into the Titustown precinct, they were asked, are you here to vote in the, you know, 87th or, you know, the, you know, the 89th? Or
do you know?
Oh, do you know, exactly. Very confusing and very costly to localities to program those machines. Two more questions, then we're going to have some discussion between our candidates and our members of the House of Delegates. When would a new redistricting system need to be adapted so changes could actually occur? what really happens after the 2020 census. So that's probably a combination question there. So when does something needs to happen in order for the legislature to draw maps or bipartisan commission reform commission to have maps ready for the...
Sure.
You want to take it? I can, but I've said plenty. Go ahead.
Sure. I will say that the to amend the Virginia Constitution is a complex process. It has to pass the General Assembly twice with an election in between those times, and then after, and then it has to go to a ballot referendum by the people. I'm not worried about that. I know you guys are going to come through for us if we get it that far. The trick is getting it through the General Assembly. And not by law, but by practice, the General Assembly only hears that first time around, what's called a first read. They only hear that in odd years. So that means we got one more shot. We got 2019, January of 2019, to get it through. What will happen then, hopefully we'll win in 2019, then there's an intervening election that November for the whole General Assembly. And then January of 2020, we're getting close, January 2020, it's got to pass on the second read. And then November of 2020 would go to the ballot for us to pick. Now, we only need to win by 50% plus one. I feel pretty good about that. But it would be just in the nick of time for redistricting to occur in 2020. And that's the clutch. I think in April of 2011 was when the maps were passed before. Because I believe Virginia gets the census data in like late February or early March or something like that by the time we all get that. So.
Well, and that's one way it can happen. And that would be the legislation that we worked on this year that I introduced. That's the constitutional amendment. But there certainly can also be litigation. There can be court decisions that would impact this. And also there could be individual pieces of legislation that don't require an amendment to the Constitution that could be adopted by the legislature. But I think we understand realistically that's probably not going to pass. So we're really looking at making this a referenda. But there are other ways in addition to that that it could pass. You know, this year we could pass legislation where the entire House and Senate agree and the governor signs something that says, you know, we're going to do this in a bipartisan way and accept the commission.
Yeah. Well, and the last part, you know, when Bob McDonald was governor, he set up a really good independent commission in 2011. It was bipartisan, had a lot of credibility. There were a lot of smart, good working folks there, and I think it had the bipartisan cred that you would hope for. They worked hard and produced really good maps. Those were largely ignored by the General Assembly at the time, but you could imagine a scenario where that we do that again, but the next governor of Virginia says, I'm going to veto everything that doesn't look like this or approximately like this advisory commission's map. And if the kids don't come to an agreement, then the courts will have an opportunity to remedy it. And I think those advisory commission maps would play a big role as well. So I hope we can kind of build on what Governor McDonald did in the next cycle for this as well.
Okay, good.
So here's the last question before we go to the candidates. There have been several reform bills introduced in the General Assembly. Can you describe the difference between them? And last part of that, which ones should we, the community, support? Jill, that may be a question that you
would
want to kick off.
I've talked about the different options and which one. I mean, everybody has strong feelings about which one is more effective. I think we reached the conclusion this year that it was by far the better way to go to actually put it in the Constitution. So it is there, and you cannot change it. I don't know, Brian, you're probably actually better equipped to speak to all the ways that you've tried to come at this.
Yeah, there are a lot of ways to fix this, right? Iowa has a different system than Florida, than California, than Washington. Any of these would be better than what Virginia has right now. So we're down for that. We're not dogmatic about the exact fix. But I would say there's kind of like maybe three tiers to this. The top tier, the hope we could do is get a commission. I would say an independent or nonpartisan commission. I don't want it just to be six Republicans and six Democrats, and then they get together and they appoint a 13th person who's hopefully a saint to do this, and then it's just like she ends up being a swing vote. That's not the way to do it, right? So a well-structured commission with some transparency. Then the step below that would be, let's do the Florida style, which is just a series of good government criteria that the General Assembly, if they choose to do it themselves, has to follow. I think that would empower an advisory commission like Bob McDonald had to be a little more authoritative, because if they came through and say, hey, here is the way to actually do this by splitting the fewest number of localities, that would be a plus. And then the last part is the kind of the bronze medal here, which I would say is the least we can do, is we have to make it illegal for politicians to go under oath in these court cases and say, I did it because they were fill-in-the-blank party. Right? that has to be, like, racial gerrymandering is illegal. So when they say, I did not do it because they were black, I did it because they're Democrats, that should be equally offensive, mm-hmm. right? And they do, right? And that's just the way, and I don't hate the player, I really hate the game, though. And we can fix it by just making at least that part against the law.
Okay. Can I just add,
yes, please.
I just want to quickly add to that, that I feel like for years now, everyone said, oh, it's too hard to change. There's this, you know, difficult constitutional amendment, you know, process, and there, it's really an uphill battle. But I feel like thanks to Brian and Senator Vogel and a lot of the real enthusiasm in the state for reform, I feel like there's a real tidal wave of public interest in doing something about this. I look out at the audience, and I'm just amazed that there are this many people here to talk about this issue. And so I think if there was ever a time that there was going to be momentum to get something done, it's now. So I hope people will continue, you know, to spread the word about this issue and to work on it, because it definitely could be better than it is.
No place to go but up.
Yeah, good. All right, thank you. We're going to hear from our panelists again in closing remarks. But before we do that, I'm going to allow members of the General Assembly and those who are running to come and give us 2 minutes. And I'll have Ron to come right to the podium. We'll start with Delegate Joe Lindsay. He's a senior person in service. And then we'll go right down the list. Joe, you have 2 minutes.
I think I'm going to do justice to the 2 minutes. I knew that I was invited to come and listen and learn, did not know that I was going to be a participant. I will say to you that the challenge comes with making people do right when their self-interest is to do something otherwise. And long story short, that's what you're hearing here today. When there is a choice between setting up the map to ensure re-election or simply setting up the map to make it a challenging election, people tend to go with their self-interest. I serve on the Privileges and Elections Committee for the House of Delegates, and I've served on it for the last 3 years. And what I found in each and every session is that there are well-meaning people who present very good ideals for an objective and bipartisan solution to gerrymandering. And there is a greater will to suborn that will. So unless we have a united front from good-minded people such as those here in attendance, really keeping the pressure on, I can tell you it won't happen by itself. It'll be dragged out a little bit. It may get out of subcommittee on some occasions. It won't see the light of day past committee, and that's because the process is such, and I'm going to steal a term from Brian, where the game is situated to suit that objective. So until we change the structure of what we have going on, what we're going to always have is that we'll take it all the way to the end, and then the matter will die. Quite honestly, I don't think the will is still there within the General Assembly, and that's a shame. But I do think that the pressures that are brought on by citizens in the community and also by the court cases that are working their way through gives a lot of hope for what we can do going forward. So we just got to keep that fight going forward.
Thank you, Joe. All right. Willie?
Good evening, everyone. I'm Willie Randall, and I'm running in the 100th District. I can tell you I do support the idea of having an independent commission to draw the lines. I do have some experience with it at the county level because we have drawn lines and maps. And I can tell you, in my view, there is a conflict of interest when you have your own legislators drawing their own line. And that is something that we really do need to address. So, when elected, that is something that I will strongly work towards, is untangling the mess of gerrymandering. I see it in the district that I'm attempting to represent right now. Can you imagine, I live on the Eastern Shore, we jump across the Chesapeake Bay, we veer off to the right all the way to West Ocean View, corner up into Ward's Corner, sneak around Suburban Park, It's just unbelievable to have a line drawn like that. And we know why it was drawn like that. We know why it was done like that. But I can assure you that me, will not stand for it going forward when elected. We're going to make some changes, folks, and we're going to do it right. We're going to represent the people that we are supposed to represent and not someone so far to the right, you can't pull them back to the left. Thank you.
Good afternoon, folks. My name is Terry Hurst. I'm running for House of Delegates in the 89th District right here to provide credible, competent, and honest leadership for you in Richmond. To do that, it's going to take scandal-free transparency and well-managed government. And one of the things that we know is redistricting is not well-managed government at this point. But I can tell you this. I was nominated as the Libertarian candidate for the 89th District. And when I decided to run for this district, someone looked at me and said, you know that district's been held by a Democrat since the Civil War, right? And I said, well, I wonder why that is. And when we look at partisan redistricting, we know exactly why. And no offense to our esteemed colleague from the Republican Party, but it's been mentioned here today, the GOP dominates the House of Delegates. And when it comes to undoing what they've done, they're going to do whatever they have to make sure it doesn't get undone. And one of the questions I would have for the panel is a question I ask myself every day. What would happen if Virginia started electing some third-party candidates? What would happen to the calculus that is currently used for partisan redistricting, right? So that's just one thought. If you upset the calculus they use, they have to find a new way to do it.
There'd be a libertarian district.
What's that?
There'd be a libertarian district.
There would be a libertarian district. Maybe a few, all right?
Thank you, man. Thank you. Let me just make one point. When the Democrats was in control, we drew lines to protect the incumbents as well. So it's just not a Republican issue. Okay? All right. Sir, come on up.
Good afternoon. Thank you all for coming today. My name is David Rose Carmack. I'm running in the 83rd District, which is northeast Norfolk and northwest Virginia Beach. This issue, the redistricting issue, is actually my number one issue. If you look at the literature I put out, it's always at the top, and it's because of this fundamental belief that I have that if your system is fundamentally broken, it cannot be expected to fix anything else. So with all of the other goals, this has to come first. This and so many other ways that we can improve our elections to make them actually listen to the people. With regard specifically to this issue, one of the reasons I actually decided to run is because of the overwhelming sense I had that our system stopped listening to the people. It is easy to feel that way when you walk into the ballot box 8 years in a row to vote for House of Delegates and you don't have a choice. It has been one person and only one person. I wrote in my old delegate, who I don't even know if she lives in the district, back when it was the 87th, two elections in a row. The election in 2015 was on my mom's birthday, so I wrote her in because no one was on the ballot who I agreed with, who represented my values. And this year came around and I said, something's gotta give. If you want something to change, you gotta change something. So one of the things I did want to say is that when you have this, not only does it diminish choice, but it also increases partisanship. Because when you are concentrating partisan, when you're drawing these lines based on party lines instead of community lines, you give politicians this a reason to represent their base instead of the community. And that is, it's a huge part of the reason why we turn on CNN and see our politicians fighting with one another over everything. And it's the reason that politics has become what it is today, and this is so critical, a critical step to moving toward a system where we can actually work together and solve all the other issues we face.
Thank you very much. Jay Jones.
Good afternoon, everybody. How you guys doing? My name is Gerald Jones. I go by Jay, and I'm running in the 89th District. I'm the Democratic nominee, and I hope to represent many of you come November. Norfolk is not innocent in this gerrymandering issue. We are standing just a few blocks away from a polling place right here at the Clarkson Museum. And I grew up four blocks that way, but I voted against Square my whole life. That is crazy to me that we've got these districts that are drawn this way. My good friend, Joe Lindsay, who is the representative in the 90th district, and I have had so many conversations about what we can do to help assist this issue and make Norfolk a place where we've got fairly drawn districts. I really applaud what my friend Brian Cannon has done with One Virginia 2021. If elected, I support everything that they are talking about, because we've got to make sure that we take the power away from the legislators and give it back to the people. We should not choose who votes for us. You should choose who represents you. And so it's critical that we all continue to make this issue something that we talk about all the time. It is very easy for Republicans and Democrats to jump on and say, we're going to work together to do this, but it's another thing to actually put it into practice. And so it's going to take all of you, I appreciate you guys coming this afternoon, to come and step up and tell your neighbors and tell your friends, because Virginia has got to be a leader. We are so proud of what we do in the Commonwealth, but this is a place where we lag far behind our peers, and so it's imperative that we take action going forward. So thank you all very, very much.
Well, thank you. So we're going to have closing comments, and I'll make my closing comments, and then we'll go to Senator Vogel and Brian Cannon and then Professor Green. My comment is very brief. The way that we can fix this is to improve on low voter turnout. In 2014, it was the lowest voter turnout in 72 years, not only in Virginia, across America. Only 36.6% of the people voted in the midterm election when Mark Warner and Ed Gillespie were running for U.S. Senate. But that's not all. In 2016, in the race for mayor, it was the highest in modern times, but it was only 27% of people who turned out to vote for Kenny Alexander or Andy Protegerald or Bob McCabe. 27%. The way that we can change gerrymandering by voting for candidates who pledge, who take a pledge that they will not support partisan redistricting. That is the quickest, easiest way, short of a legal remedy or a legislative remedy, is called elections. Thank you very much. Gio Vogel.
It's hard to improve on that, so I will say yes to what he said. And also, it's just really important that as you are talking about this issue in your community and encouraging people to think about it and be advocates for this and engage people who are running for office on this subject, the other big piece of this is that to do good work, and I mentioned before, it's a constituent service matter, but to do really good work, when you dilute districts, either that are very urban and have grave urban concerns about transportation, or very large rural districts who are desperate to have one person who will go there and be an advocate on their agriculture issues, when you dilute those districts and you send people who really aren't accountable, what you get is bad government. You get poor policy. You get people who don't have the ability to dig deep and really understand what that issue is because they have so many masters. So I would say if you care about a well-run state, a well-managed Commonwealth of Virginia, you should care a lot about redistricting reform.
You've been listening to a panel on redistricting that took place on September 10th. Tonight's program was recorded by Kate Mishkin and edited by Benjamin Dolly. The executive producer is Bill Miller. The views expressed on the WCVE Forum are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the management and staff of WCVE Public Radio.